Estos días el canciller Ayala acoge la actuación de uno de los más grandes pianistas de jazz del momento. Es todo un veterano a sus 50 y tantos años, 50 y poquitos años, y está estas noches con el trío Kenny Bernoy, Johannes van der Müller y Ari Hennig. El otro día charlábamos con él brevemente, me apetecía una conversación más pausada, más relajada, porque creo que es uno de los nombres más interesantes de la actualidad y con él vamos a estar. Kenny, welcome again.
Thank you.
Vamos a ir charlando poquito a poco. Estos días la conversación aquí giraba en torno a la calidad del trío que estás liderando con Ari Hennig, con Johannes van der Müller. Nos comentabas, es una música para escuchar. ¿Qué características tiene esa música del trío de Kenny Bernard?
Quality of your trio, the high quality of your trio. It's a music to listen to it. How are the characteristics of that music?
Well, for one thing, I try not to think of it as a piano trio, because I don't really like a lot of piano trios. They're usually not good bands. They might be a great piano player, but the bass player and drummer are not involved. They're just accompanying the piano player. So while I might admire the piano player's virtuosity, I am not captured by the band. So the next step is to have a band that reacts to each other, where each person can make a compositional contribution. And then I react to that. I react to their ideas, and it makes me play differently. Just one other thing, the next level from that is a band that plays so well together that it sounds like an orchestra, playing specific ideas. I believe this band has reached that level. And the final thing is, it doesn't mean anything if you can't bring all that stuff back to the heart so that people can walk in and feel your music, even if they know nothing about jazz.
Estamos demasiado acostumbrados en estos tiempos, sobre todo en el lenguaje de la música pop, que lleva cantante, a un protagonista, un nombre protagonista, y detrás una banda acompañando. Quizá ese es el concepto que más se está repitiendo hoy por hoy, trasladándolo al mundo del trío de piano. Un solista, habitualmente pianista, y un batería y un contrabajo que simplemente están para seguir los caprichos, el devenir del piano.
And basically in the world of pop music, we are accustomed to see a band who is composed by one star, who is mostly a singer, but sometimes an instrumentalist. Is that the role that has infected most of jazz music today? One star and the rest company.
The problem with jazz today is that it's trying to imitate the pop world. And why that's very sad is because jazz is one of the musics that has, in the past, represented real truth. That's why it's admired, jazz is admired and respected around the world. It's not like McDonald's. People hate McDonald's, but they're addicted to McDonald's. America is very good at addicting people. But jazz is the only really quality product, the philosophy that was, maybe not so much anymore, of a human being incorporating, you know, really it's an American thing. You're not playing Spanish music, you're not playing Cuban music, you're playing from the mind of an improviser. And he can use and synthesize all the ideas of the entire world that in that moment. Jazz reminds me of a place in America where there used to be a very great Indian tribe. If you go there now, there's just a tobacco store and an old gas station and a McDonald's.
Si este análisis que comenta del trío de jazz de contrabajo, piano, batería actual se puede trasladar a la historia, si también ese concepto de solista trasladado del mundo del pop se producía antaño. En todo caso, por un lado eso, y por otro, ¿qué tríos de piano, contrabajo y batería desde los inicios de ese tipo de formación hasta la actualidad podemos considerar como realmente a tener en cuenta?
Did that concept of the trio of a star and two company is possible to see examples of that in the history, and also what trios all trios are more in vain with the your model of a trio.
As far as piano trio, I think Bill Evans is the best example of a trio that plays together and creates together. And Art Tatum is the best example of a trio where you don't even notice the rest of the trio. It's all Art Tatum. So they both have their history. I just prefer, in myself, great bands. I don't want to hear an individual. I want a sound to come at me, and then I want that sound to hypnotize me. So I create a band that, for that, you know, that I like to listen to.
Vivimos unos tiempos en el jazz que, bueno, atienden a un cierto revisionismo. Estos días mismo en el Polideportivo de Mendizorroza, en esta edición del Festival de Jazz, hemos tenido ejemplos muy obvios. Por ejemplo, era el caso anoche de Marcus Miller, con un trompetista que quería sonar a Miles, cuya función era ser Miles sobre el escenario. Lo hemos visto también en otras actuaciones estos días, hay mil y un ejemplos. ¿Vive el jazz fundamentalmente norteamericano en este momento un cierto exceso revisionista?
There's a nowadays there is in jazz trend of revisionism. Yesterday we were saying Marcus Miller band with a trumpet player who was matching in Miles fashion. Is there an excess of revisionism today in American jazz?
That's putting it very mildly. Excess is totally what's happening. The problem is this. Jazz grew from the sincere desire from a human being to get in touch with his own voice. And when somebody does that, when they get in touch with their voice, they touch everybody around them. Because just like a rapper, when a rapper finds his real message, 1,000 other people go, yeah, yeah, that's right, that's the way I feel. So in that way, a poet or a musician can speak for many other souls. Then it becomes an important thing. Actually, it becomes music history. But then the next generation, and generations after, they don't contact that inner self. They think the message is those musicians who contacted their inner self. In other words, a trumpet player would think he's heavy, that the way to find truth is to play like Miles Davis. And not only will that trumpet player never have the power of Miles Davis, I take you back to the idea of an African tribe or an Indian tribe, right? The power is in being in their presence. There's no power in having a photograph. But most jazz today is a photograph. Yeah. And that works very well for media, because media shows photograph. But the whole thing obscures the truth. And that's why you see some of the silly musicians who are featured in the media.
Todo eso tiene un problema también, y es que el jazz es una música con muchísima historia, con muchísimos años y nombres que han creado ya pues la tradición, que han ido abriendo los caminos de esta música. Es difícil abstraerse después de tanto legado a la hora de crear o intentar crear nuevos caminos, a la hora de tener una voz propia. Es difícil abstraerse de lo conocido, de todo ese legado, de toda esa biblioteca del jazz.
Given that jazz has provided a so extensive list of important names, it is very difficult, very hard to get a part of that list, to be abstracted.
That's what you think. Because you don't value your own self as much as you value Miles Davis. Miles Davis' great secret, and Thelonious Monk's great secret, is that they had the highest respect for their own ideas. If you combine that respect, that love, with training, and you train yourself. You train yourself like a priest reads the Bible over and over again. You train yourself on harmony, rhythm, and melody. But then you give it up to this spirit inside you. You know, this is the game of life, mastery. Mastery. It's the same thing they do in martial arts, in painting, in anything. It's the combination of training, going to higher and higher levels of expertise, with higher and higher levels of inspiration.
Estamos también con Sergio Cabanillas y Guillermo Bachola, que está siendo la voz en castellano de Kenny Werner. Por supuesto, en el momento en que queráis participar y preguntarle a Kenny Werner, estáis en vuestro derecho, ¿eh? En todo caso, podemos hacer un pequeño viaje cronológico por la música de Kenny Werner, que nacía en el año 1951 en Brooklyn, en concreto el 19 de noviembre. Actualmente, nosotros, los músicos actuales, disponemos de todo ese legado que estábamos comentando como materia de estudio. Pero entonces, en 1951, no, porque todavía no podría tocar el piano, pero un poquito más adelante, ¿cómo fue ese primer contacto, esos inicios de Kenny Werner con la música? Imagino también que con el jazz directamente.
We would like to do a chronological travel across your career. How was your first contact with jazz music?
Well, I didn't have my first contact with... My first contact with jazz music was in junior high school. A friend of mine, a saxophone player named Sammy Morrison, actually played with Miles Davis for a little while. He didn't record with him. And we grew up around the block from each other. And he played me my favorite things, John Coltrane. And at the time, I hated it. Because I was into pop music, and I thought, this is going on too long, and it's all the same thing. I really didn't like it. But then my serious connection with jazz happened when I went to college. That was the first real jazz I started to listen to. My roommate was sort of a Charlie Parker-type alto player. And I still wasn't in love with it, but I was an improviser, and jazz was the most available way to improvise. And then somebody played me a record that had just come out with Miles Davis called In a Silent Way. And that was it. I was gone on that. And you see, that's still my standard for a group, because when you listen to that record, and a few of Miles's records are like this, when you listen to those records, you don't really notice any one person. You feel the vibration coming out of the stereo of the whole group. So in a way, I try to go for that in my trio.
Adquirido de su página web un larguísimo currículum, así que yo prácticamente no voy a ir mirándolo porque, bueno, pues podríamos pegarnos horas y horas. Así que si te parece, Kenny, puedes hacernos tú mismo pues el resto del currículum, pero en propia palabra, cuéntanos un poquito.
There's a long bio extracted from your website, so it's too long, so perhaps it would be better if you want to tell about your career, your resume.
Well, I had a CD, I had a record out when I was 11, and it was like a little bit of a pop record on piano. It sold about 5 copies.
Así que si el otro día teníamos con Wynton Marsalis al chavalín de 14, todavía lo de Kenny Werner es mayor precocidad.
We saw the other day with Wynton Marsalis this kid of 14.
Yeah.
14 years, so you were more precocious.
Well, the kid played better than I played it.
Okay.
At that time, much better. But then I, my first real CD was I was asked to make a CD of the music of Bix Beiderbecke, James P. Johnson, Duke Ellington, and George Gershwin, written music. And then my next record was, I was on Charles Mingus's record, Something Like a Bird. And then nothing happened for quite a few years. And then in the early 80s, I formed a trio, which I had for 14 years, and also started to go in the early 80s to Europe, and I played for a few years with Archie Shepp. Then I joined the Mel Lewis Orchestra, which I played with for 10 years, and that took me into the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And along the way, I played with, you know, singular time, one time or more, with Dizzy Gillespie or Stan Getz one time. I didn't play with his band, but one time I played with him. I was in Eddie Gomez's band for a while, people like that. Ron Carter's band, Tom Harrell's band for a few years. And all the time I kept my own trio going and my composing. Over that time I composed for the Danish Radio Orchestra, the VDR, various European orchestras, and for the Mel Lewis Orchestra. And I won several composing awards in America and grants and things like that. I got to write for some orchestra, and that's my latest passion, is trying to write for orchestra or even possibly be able to score movies. I would really like to do that.
Dentro de esas bandas sonoras, ¿qué películas? Es una curiosidad.
Have you done what scores, soundtracks did you do?
No, I've just done little documentaries and just nothing you would have seen. But I really think that before I came to jazz, I was much more interested in film. And I think I would have been a movie writer if I hadn't gone to Berkeley. And all my friends became jazz musicians, so I became a jazz musician.
Ahora que mencionas Berkeley, es una eterna polémica la calidad de enseñanza o el academicismo, mejor dicho, de la enseñanza de esta escuela. Son muchos, por ejemplo, los músicos europeos que viajan hasta Estados Unidos, a Boston, a Berkeley en concreto, y la polémica se genera en torno a si el producto Berkeley es un producto académico, un producto estándar, donde los músicos que salen de allí suenan prácticamente con un sonido muy concreto y prefijado. Yo no sé qué valor le das a la enseñanza en Berkeley, quizá en el momento que tú lo viviste y también visto desde la actualidad, si tienes algún tipo de conocimiento de lo que allí pasa.
Given that you named Berkeley, there's an argument about the quality of teaching of that school, and what do you think about that school and their method, and if there is a way, a Berkeley style of teaching and playing?
Well, I was a composer in residence at Berkeley a few years ago, but other than that one semester, I haven't been around Berkeley much to tell you what they're doing. But I'm sure the education is there. I mean, they recently hired Joe Lovano. Joe Lovano does his own thing there. The problem is not, you know, the quality of the teaching everywhere has gotten very good. When I first started, they didn't exactly know how to teach jazz. And, you know, there may be a Berkeley way, but if you see some of the people who have graduated, they sound very different from each other. I mean, you have Pat Metheny was there, but you also have Joe Lovano was there. Those are totally two different voices. The problem with Berkeley and a lot of the schools, is not that they don't teach you how to play. They've really learned how to do that. To me, there's two problems, and they're both huge problems. One is that because schools are accredited and they have to cover a certain amount of material, that leaves many people who aren't quite talented enough to keep up with that. It makes them waste their time. Those people might have become musicians or might have become better musicians had someone found their rhythm for learning and coached them from that point. That happens to be 90% of every school, those people. So their tuition basically finances the few musicians who are big talents who the school wants to feature. And the other big problem is that you can teach people how to play, but you can't teach them why to play. And so the result is you have a lot of people that play their instruments very, very well, but nobody needs to hear them. Again, they don't touch that spiritual element, which is what makes music important.
¿Es un ejemplo Wynton Marsalis?
Is Wynton Marsalis an example of that?
Well, Wynton is a very unusual case. I have a lot of respect for what he's done. At first I resented what he did, because he basically took all the mystical aspects and creative aspects that I worshipped, and he kind of just put them down when he first came on the scene. And he accentuated the tradition and the history. And now I've come around to believe that that was the right time that had to happen. It was like natural law that that would happen, to correct the music. There's always a correction, you know. You know, the problem is that after 10 years of that, then it needed a correction the other way. You have all these little jazz robots walking around that play or sound and dress and everything exactly like some other person. And that needed correction. And I believe that correction is happening now. Even the musicians that come to the jam session, and they see what a creative musician does, and now they're ready to hear that. Even Wynton's ready to hear that. I could see that, you know. When Wynton was in his most reactive mode, I predicted someday he's going to turn around and say, no, you got to explore, you got to be free. Because improvisation is like the universe, it's always expanding. You can't remain closed forever. So I think in spite of his earlier beliefs, Wynton is expanding. But I have to say something. I am a better musician today and a much better piano player because of Wynton Marsalis. Because he did find a great weakness in the music that was going on before he came along. And that was that people weren't well trained enough and that they were not rooted enough in the tradition. Today, everybody plays with a stronger beat because of that focus on the origin of the music, the rhythm. So maybe in the 70s I was a spirit just flying around the air. But when Wynton brought in his movement, it forced me to also plant my feet in the soil. And the total result is I'm a much more powerful player today. So it's a each movement comes to correct the previous movement. But I might just be here to be a correction of the most recent movement. I hope.
En definitiva, seguir evolucionando como músico, pero incluso el jazz como lenguaje siempre se ha caracterizado por ser una música que evolucionaba, que avanzaba. ¿Significa la evolución el separarse en cada momento del público? ¿Siempre la vanguardia ha sido un concepto que se alejaba del público, pero aún así tiene que ser así en el caso del jazz?
Do you think that evolution means necessarily that music gets apart from the audiences? Always avant-garde were accused to get a part of the audience.
Well, you see, jazz started as a pop music. It started as a dance music. It started as a whorehouse music, actually, you know. And as it grew, as an art form, it grew away from people. That's what always happens. You could say that the music was moving apart from the audience at the point of bebop. When Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie played that music, nobody understood it. And Louis Armstrong pronounced that music's not happening. So it really hasn't been a street music, meaning it hasn't been like simple melody, simple harmony, since bebop. But avant-garde was a further moving away. But you know, you have to understand also that every music was influenced by other music. There were avant-garde players that were trying to imitate, say, the way the Miles Davis Quintet played with fast time. But they couldn't play the form, therefore they were avant-garde. Of course, you might argue that the, you know, with John Cage and chance music and things that have and minimalists. I like what Keith Jarrett said about minimalists. He said he's tired of minimalists who run out of idea. But there were avant-garde musicians that would do something that appealed to very few people, but they were specifically not trying to reach an audience. They were trying to prove a philosophy. The analogy is that they were more like pure scientists rather than entertainers.
En todo caso, se confirma con esas palabras de Kenny Werner mi sospecha de que dentro del jazz de vanguardia hay mucha mentira. El que no puede tocar melódico muchas veces se engaña a sí mismo con un lenguaje que también poco tiene que ver con la vanguardia, en definitiva.
These words confirm his suspect about that. In the avant-garde, there are a lot of lies, because many people that can't play melodic are playing strange and confusing.
Well, see, that was happening a lot in the late 70s, and that's what I believe created a vacuum that was filled by Wynton Marsalis. And he came along and he quite accurately observed, these cats can't play. But he also said Miles can't play, so he kind of pissed off a lot of older musicians as well.
Estamos llegando al final de nuestra conversación con Kenny Werner, pero no quiero que ni Sergio Cabanillas ni Guillermo Bachola se queden con alguna pregunta en el tintero. Antes me comentaba Sergio que tenía algo en mente para preguntarle al propio Kenny Werner.
Quería preguntar en ese concepto, en esos dos extremos que planteaba del trío de piano, entre Art Tatum y el trío de Bill Evans, hay un nombre, un gran olvidado. A ver si lo coloca en uno de los extremos o en el medio. Talking about the two extremes you were talking about before, with Art Tatum in one side and the other side Bill Evans trio, where would you place Oscar Peterson trio with Ray Brown and Thigpen?
I would still place them closer to Art Tatum's trio. I mean, of course Ray Brown made wonderful contributions, or Joe Pass or whoever, but the people didn't notice that. It was all Oscar Peterson. You know, There's nothing wrong with that. I'm just talking about my own taste. I'm much more intrigued by a group that sends out a sound than an individual. Because even the records, you just listen to that guy's solo over and over again. But I already heard those notes. Mm-hmm. You have to hear, for me, I have to hear something overall. And then it has, and I'm a bit of a psychedelic person myself. I want a mystical feeling to come over me. Uh-huh. Now, Oscar did that for me a few times, but most of the time he was just playing brilliant piano.
Y también le quería preguntar, estos días se han subido a tocar con él un par de músicos españoles de tronío, como son Perico Sanbeat o Marc Miralta, por ejemplo. Entonces, le quiero preguntar qué pensaba antes de oír a los jazzísticos españoles y qué piensa ahora. You have the chance to play with a couple of great Spanish musicians on the jam sessions, like Perico Sanbeat and Marc Miralta.
Yeah.
What did you used to think about Spanish jazzmen, and what do you think now about them?
Well, I mean, I don't think I could just say Spanish. There used to be a thing about European jazz musicians, that they didn't swing, and that they didn't play as hip as American musicians. But that's no longer true. The two musicians you just mentioned play as great as anybody I've ever heard. And I had a great time playing with them last night. I also have to say that I don't think about the fact that they're Spanish. I don't like this whole nationalistic idea about music. Music is higher than nations, you know? And when someone learns a language, when I look at that musician, I'm not thinking, he's Spanish. I'm thinking, are you creative or not? That's all I want to know. And can you swing or can you play? Are you well trained? The two questions. Are you creative? Do you have a heart? Do you have a soul? Do you have an urge? And are you well trained? That's the two questions.
Guillermo, te reservamos la última pregunta, aunque te leeremos también una extensa entrevista con Kenny Warner en Cuadernos de Jazz, pero a riesgo de que te echen la bronca desde la redacción, te reservamos la última, la puntilla.
Más que pregunta, en realidad quiero resaltar un hecho, que es que durante este tiempo que llevamos, estos días que llevamos aquí, donde nos hemos visto varias veces con Kenny Warner, algo que me ha llamado la atención es cómo todos los músicos que pasan y lo ven se acercan a saludarlo, lo que demuestra que hay un gran aprecio personal y un gran, enorme respeto y reverencia musical hasta a este músico. Y eso es una cosa que no todo el tiempo sucede, que más allá del común sentimiento de camaradería entre los músicos, lo que yo he notado de todos los músicos, ya sean los jóvenes músicos de jazz, locales, americanos, los músicos de funk o quien sea, todos se acercan y le dan un abrazo a Kenny. Eso es una cosa que no me parece usual.
He's talking about all the musicians that came around the hotel, if they get onto the stage or not, they all went to you and really hold you. He has seen lots of respect and reverence to your person, more than being jazz companions. Said, hey, how are you doing? They were reverent to you.
Well, they must. I appreciate it. I don't need reverence from anybody at all. You know, I really
respect.
Respect is nice.
Yeah.
But I guess what it is that maybe I don't know. I don't know what to say. And maybe it's everything that I'm about helps inspire them to be what they are about. And if I influence them to be that, then I'm happy to be that, you know. The other thing is, we're fighting in this music a media that's trying to imitate the pop world. So in jazz, gold is not worth the price of gold, and aluminum is not worth the, you know, I mean, gold is worth copper, and copper is worth gold. In other words, jazz is not on the gold standard, so to speak. In other words, the greatest musicians are not necessarily on the front page of the magazine. And the media is not covering the greatest musicians, they're covering the people who they think can bring in advertising dollars. So I consider myself sort of a soldier in the army of creative people, but we have a responsibility. We have to move people. You can't just play hip. You have to touch people. People have to say, I don't know anything about this music, but my life has just changed. And that's my only defense is, if I believed what the media does, then I would be at Berkeley teaching other young little kids to get their diplomas and their Blue Note contracts. The media doesn't think that the new music could be coming from someone who's 51 years old, who's balding a lot, no hair, from old age, and is not a sex symbol. Well, you know, I'm really, the media is like the Matrix. And the Matrix defines everything. And so I consider myself, one of those people that's not in the Matrix. And I am attacking from without. I'm saying, tell the truth just once in a while. Can you tell the truth? You know, just occasionally. Well, you know, the Matrix destroys everything. The first time I went to Istanbul, I wanted to hear the music of Istanbul. And I walked down the street, and what do you think I heard? The Backstreet Boys. It kills everything in its path.